Okay, so I will leave the stage soon and give over to Florian Kramer, but give a very short introduction of his field. I will not give you the list of his publication, but more like a personal profile, so that you feel some things we present here may sound a little bit dry compared to the other awards, but there is always a life behind that, which maybe is not so dry at all, you know. And Florian was so kind to give me his kind of secret CV. That he started already in the 80s, from 82 on, in the post-punk underground culture, making a fanzine. And that since 82, he is a basic user and homebrew computer hacker. And that already in 1984, which is a long ago for somebody born in 1969, he did his own kind of random poetry on a computer. So he started with producing his own work that later became his own poetic work that later became the field of his academic research. Maybe he slipped some of his own work in his PhD. We still have to find that out. Okay. Because he worked also anonymously in the subculture of Neoism, for example, together with Stuart Holm. And then from 2000 on, he collaborated with a couple of net artists, for example, with the Old Boys Network and with Jaromil Merz and Cornelia Solfrank, Sebastian Lütgert. So in the more academic career, he has been studying art history, found this pretty boring, switched over to interdisciplinary literary science, and found there that in the history of the 20th century avant-garde, many of the contemporary practice found a much more long-standing historical background, so that made also his emphasis on the more recent production, put it more, dimmed it down a little bit, and he said, okay, these things are not so new as they are pretended to be. You can go back 50 years or maybe 200 or maybe 1,000 years, and you will find similar things in this specific field of research. He has been working on the Freie University of Berlin as a staff lecturer, and since 2006 is now director of the MA Studia Media Design at the Piet Zwart Institute at the Willem de Koning Academy in Rotterdam, which he is actually doing. Okay, welcome, Florian. And,
okay, I'm also speaking in English, but I have to disappoint you first because as you see, my work has an English title, but it's written in German, and that's the big mistake I made. I made two mistakes. I wrote it in German, and I wrote 350 pages, so nobody's going to read it. And I'll give you a rundown in hopefully half an hour that gives you enough knowledge of that. My idea was to briefly characterize what this whole thing is about, then maybe read a little bit from a sample chapter so that you get an impression of the style, and then also summarize the conclusion, because what I really appreciate that I was given the first of the media research awards, but in fact what I'm doing in the end of my book is to bash the term media, so I appreciate the tolerance of the jury. So as Dieter said, it's my PhD thesis in comparative literature. And the title, executable statements or exe-cut-upable statements, cut-upable statements, cuttable statements, that's borrowed from a code work by the Australian net artist Mez. And I think it just beautifully summarizes what this whole thing is about, namely about a poetics of algorithmic writing. In fact, I have to confess that this was also the title of a lecture that I gave here at the Ars Electronica 4 years ago, but the title was just so good, and it was just such a good characterization of the field that I was covering that I used it again. Another thing is that perhaps some of you might be familiar with an online book publication that I completed in 2005, which is called Words Made Flesh. And this is the cover. It's on the homepage of the Piet Zwart Institute. And, whoop, this goes a little bit fast. In fact, there's an overlap. What is the similarity and the difference? Well, the subject is practically the same. Words Made Flesh is something like a more compact, more popular, less academic version of what I'm presenting right now. It's 140 pages versus 350 pages, so it's more accessible. But I would also say that the new thing, that the German PhD thesis, it is much more thorough, also more thorough in its criticism and its analysis. It's much more focused on literary studies and poetry, literature, and skips a few references in software culture and popular computer culture that I have in this book, although there's also weird stuff about Jess Franco, cannibal movies, porn, and what have you. So it's my usual bag of obsessions that I managed to wrap up into this thesis. So what can I say? Also, those of you who know my work a little bit, I have been working in this field of, or this intersection of computer culture, net culture, art, and literature since more than 10 years, and written quite extensively on it. Most of the stuff, or practically all of it, is freely available on my homepage. And if you're familiar with that stuff, you will see it is not so new. It is actually the wrap-up of the 10 years of diverse stuff that I've been doing into a more comprehensive work. I would characterize my own work as participant observation. That's a term borrowed from the ethnologist Bronislaw Malinowski, and it means that as a researcher, you observe, but you also participate. So I'm also getting my hands dirty with contemporary cultural phenomena, and that's very important for me, and this is also what I understand is really the configuration of this award, that it finally gives recognition or a possibility for researchers who are working in those strange interdisciplinary fields between theory and practice and contemporary phenomena and historical perspective to get the recognition. In my case, it's something really pragmatically usable, because the book can now, thanks to this award, appear in print in spring 2008 with Fink Publisher in Germany. Hopefully there might be also an English edition in the future. So what are the points that I'm trying to make in this book? From the point of being a literary researcher and academic is what Dieter already said, that computation is a dimension of writing and not just a dimension of writing that has been invented with computer poetry, but where you can go back, for example, to magical language speculation, to Kabbalah, to strange poetical phenomena, for example, in the Renaissance and the 18th century. Even Romanticism had its fair share of speculation into the links between mathematical calculation and computation and language and literature. And but then while I really like to dip into code and read code, this is ultimately not what my book is about, but what I'm really interested in is rather the cultural imaginations and the utopias, the dystopias, the phantasms that get projected into those codes. And perhaps that becomes a little bit more clear if I now go into examples. But one could say that the area that I'm researching, from Kabbalistic poetry to contemporary net art by Jodi, by Mess, by others, is really about the different, sometimes really contradictory imaginations projected onto those codes. So the whole phantasm that, yeah, words becoming flesh, that statements, that language becomes executable, that somehow the symbols that we use take up a life of their own. This is a topic we know very well from science fiction literature and from utopian literature, but I would say the difference between the literature that I'm researching here in this book and conventional sci-fi and fantasy literature is that this is a literature that doesn't just describe those utopias, but actually tries to perform, to execute them, in its own writing, yeah, by actually having the own writing compute, yeah, not just writing about it, but writing in this style. And how can this look like? So I'm a bit, this is not the presentation program I normally use, but it seems to work. This is a really early example of such a computational writing by the Latin poet Optatianus Porphyrius from the 4th century AD. It's also a very funny poem, by the way. What is particular about this is that you can actually shuffle the words in it. You can shuffle the words in the first column, and you can shuffle the words in the third and the fourth column. So if you compute that, it means that you actually have several billions of possible permutations, that's the correct mathematical expression, of that poem, and Optatianus himself wrote about one dozen of the possible permutations. So you can think of this poem as a source code that, just like a computer program, gets executed, has an inscribed algorithm, and then expands and mutates in itself. And what is also particular about it, well, it's Latin, so maybe it's not easy to understand, is it's semantically it's an ironical play on Pythagorean musical harmony, since it describes how the muses are singing, but how their songs are totally disharmonic, and how the words they pronounce get shuffled. So what it describes is also what it performs in its own code. This example then was taken by the most influential poetic theorist of the Renaissance, Julius Caesar Scaliger, in the 16th century, and he canonized it into a proper form, a poetic form, which he called Proteic Verse. Proteus is the ancient Roman god who constantly changes his appearance, and so the idea was that this was a literary form that also constantly changes its experience. The sample of verse he gives is perfides perasti divus te fallere protoi, which means, heinously you, protoi, tried to fool the gods. And what you can do is you can shuffle all those words, so you can create thousands of permutations of that sentence. But what is interesting is that Scaliger does not think like Optatian in the theory of Pythagorean musical and world harmony, but he rather comes from the tradition of rhetoric, and word shuffling is his technical device of creating copious expressions from a really restrained set of words. That's the typical issue of a rhetorical speaker, that you have to memorize very few key points and then create a wealth of speech from it. This is just what this thing does. But Scaliger's invention then got quickly taken up by especially religious poets, and this goes too fast, so stop it. Okay. By religious poets in the 17th century. This here is a computational poem in praise of the Virgin Mary. Yeah? And the idea is that this is a combination wheel, and that each section of the wheel can be turned and twisted. And so you have a small computer with which you can create poems in the praise of the Virgin Mary. There are even many more examples. I'm covering them all, but I can't cover them here in the limited amount of time, where, for example, prayers for peace in the 30 Years' War were written with these devices, and then one single peace prayer was written out over hundreds of pages just as one permutation of the same basic sentence. Then, under the influence of the so-called Ars Combinatoria of Ramon Llull, and also of Kabbalah, and again, I have to stop this damn thing here. There is even the idea. Yeah, it's self-executable. Yeah, I'm just dealing with a heinousness of this technology. It also had an impact on science and linguistics. This is an idea, this is a device. It works just like the permutational Mary poem, but to compute all existing words of the German language. And it's a combination of morphemes, and the idea is that you have something like a basic language computer, and was based on very influential linguistic theories of the 17th century, which, unlike structuralism, which is very similar also in its combinatorial approach, is based on the idea that the modern languages are ultimately based on Hebrew, and Hebrew is ultimately based on the divine language. So what we have here is something like almost a reverse engineering of a divine linguistic code that then gets implemented into a technical device. And that becomes even more important. Well, this is also an example how, for an allegorical depiction, I'm going to skip that. This is a German late 17th century poet by Quirinus Kuhlmann called, the permutation or the shuffling of human matters. And damn it. So this is the permutation of human matters, indeed. And this poem is a sonnet, and it's also based on Scaliger's method of words that can be shuffled, that can be permuted. And what it does, it basically describes an inventory of the cosmos. What I'm doing in my own work is I'm devoting 90 pages to an analysis only of that poem. Yeah. So that is one of the problems also why this book really, it doesn't really fit into being, let's say, a more accessible art research book and an academic book. On those 19 pages, it's really a hardcore philologist, hardcore literary studies, and then in other parts, it's more hybrid. So to summarize those 90 pages, the point is that Kuhlmann does not just write this poem, but he also makes a theoretical commentary in several places where he speculates about a machine that could automatically write all existing and all future books of the world. And the idea is that this is something like a total poem which shuffles an entire cosmology, yeah, a complete inventory of the cosmos. In addition to that, well, there are many allegories put into this poem. One that I think that I found out that nobody found out before is that actually there's a strong intertextuality to the Proverbs of Solomon in the Bible. It uses similar structure and also sometimes similar words and similar conjunctions of words. So, and it appears in a volume of poetry by Kuhlmann, which is poetic adaptations of the Song of the Songs but of Solomon. So it makes a lot of sense that there is also this kind of coincidence. And the final line of it says, well, if you grasp the permutations of things, you will grasp the wisdom of the world. So the idea is that this is a kind of Solomonic wisdom machine, and you could describe it as a reverse engineering of an imaginary Solomonic computer. Yeah? So what it does, it is trying to look, well, what is the code of Solomon's proverbs? Yeah? How are they constructed? And how can we generate an algorithm that creates even more proverbs than Solomon could ever create? And in fact, if you exhaust all possible permutations of that poem, you have a number with 113 digits. Yeah? It's so huge that even Kuhlmann himself is unable to compute it and gets into some mathematical trouble, which is pretty funny. And also, after that, he has a mystical revelation, and he travels all through Europe declaring himself a new mystical king and prophet and trying to forge an alliance between Protestants and Muslims in order to beat down the Pope. He travels to Istanbul trying to convert the Sultan, and it doesn't work, and is ultimately burned as a heretic in Moscow. There is a very interesting political theology that is embedded into this kind of poetics at all. It's not at all just a wordplay, but it's a very thorough understanding of a language that actually moves and shakes things. If you go into the 20th century, some of you might be familiar with Tristan Tzara's Dadaist poem, which is an instruction to cut out words of a newspaper article, shuffle them in a hat, and then randomly pull them out and glue them to create a new Dadaist poem. Well, what is interesting about it, it's exactly the same algorithm that is used in proteic poetry that was described in the Poeticus by Scaliger. You don't agree? Okay. it is mathematically speaking the same idea of taking a material of words and then shuffling them. But, of course, it has completely contrary implications because it is not, as in those 17th century poems, a universal total synthesis of things. It is not the idea of creating a total artwork, of creating a world within the poem, but it's just the opposite. It's about destruction of meaning and pulling things apart. And this is what is really interesting for me, how almost identical and, well, computationally speaking, maybe even banal forms of computation in linguistics and poetry have completely different, vastly different imaginations and cultural phantasms attached to them. Then if you go into the cut-up literature of William S. Burroughs and Brian Geisen, well, how does it start? The instruction is take a newspaper article, cut it into different columns and shuffle it. Again, it's the same algorithm. Even Brian Geisen is the first poet in the 20th century to use a computer, a Honeywell machine, in order to create permutational poems. But, it's both a destruction of meaning, but it's also the creation of a new meaning where you have a kind of paranoid, pop cultural, satanic implication of that poetry. And then if you go into net art, things get even more complicated. For example, if I look at... this is Corinus Kuhlmann as a mystical king. If I look at net art works, for example, by Jodi, this is just a fragment of a text they posted on the NetTime and Rhizome mailing list some years ago. Then you could read this as a kind of concrete poetry with a very military content and structure. And it was also posted on the height of discussions on the war in Yugoslavia on that time, so it has this immediate political context. But if you're computer literate, you will recognize that it's actually source code in the programming language C. And then if you do some research, you find out it's actually part of the source code of their untitled game, which in turn is a modification of the popular ego shooter game Quake. So what happens now in the net art code works is that actually the instruction itself, the algorithms themselves are considered a poetic material. In, for example, the Dadaist poem of Tristan Tzara, there is still the separation between the instruction and the execution. The instruction is always the same. It's always the same instruction to cut out words, put them into a hat, shuffle them, and pull them out. And that instruction itself is not subject to this process. Yeah? There is no instruction to also mess with the instruction. This is the next level we get into when we talk about net art. Now, I think I don't have so much time. Yeah, it's already two.
5 more minutes, maybe, and then we have.
Yeah. So exactly. So I'm gonna skip my whole middle part. I had the idea of reading one sample section from the thesis, which is about poetics of infection. It is attached to another close reading. I have 90 pages on Kuhlmann, and I have, I think, 25 pages on this piece. This is a code work by the Australian net artist Mez, not the one where I borrowed the title from, but it's called Virologic Conditioning 1.1, and is, to describe it very, very quickly, is a hybrid of a English and computer codes, and also on the semantic level reflects both a computer virus infection and a biological flu virus infection. And I'm deriving a poetics of infection where you can differentiate, for example, pure description of infections, then the metaphorical infection, a performative infection, and then the actual self-infection of code, and how these different layers get superimposed and contaminated in many contemporary net artworks. So to talk about the conclusions, well, I could talk about a lot more. Should I maybe go into the table of contents? Perhaps that's a good idea. Okay, I don't like the macOS interface, but this should work. So this is the German table of contents. It starts with computation and phantasms as an introduction. It talks about prototypes of linguistic algorithms in magic, but also in sound poetry. Then about Pythagorean thoughts, the idea that the universe is computable and that this computability corresponds to symmetry and beauty, and which then ends up in scientific aesthetics. I'm talking about Kabbalah and Ars Combinatoria as pretext of the poetics that I'm researching, and then go into all these examples of Renaissance and 17th century permutation poetry, then the 90 pages about this one single poem, and finally talk about total algorithmic arts, and I'm also taking contemporary or modern examples, for example, from Fluxus by Lamont Young and George Brecht. I'm talking about the Library of Babel by Jorge Luis Borges as a fiction of such a total combinatorial text system. John Barth, The Literature of Exhaustion, as a reaction to experimental poetry that deals with the same facts. But also I'm talking about 18th century literature, for example, Novalis, the German romanticist, or Sade, and their reflections of algorithmics, computations, combinatorics in their own works, and go through 20th century art, Dadaism, concrete poetry, especially the parallel between early concrete poetry and cybernetics in the German Stuttgart school around Max Benze, and the French Oulipo, with its completely different program of algorithmics as a constraint and not as expansion. Criticize John Cage for being a totalitarian, a fascist in this closet, and go into also go into contemporary software art by Adrian Ward, by Wilfried Hauiebeck and his psychogeographical computer, and then look more specifically at program code poetry, per poetry, code works, works by Alan Sontheim, Jaromir, who's sitting here, Graham Harwood, and others, and have a critique of artificial intelligence, which actually is largely identical to the one in Words Made Flesh, for those of you who have read it. And then finally bash the concept of media. And maybe just 1 minute. I'm trying to explain why I think that the term media is problematic. I think there's a high risk that if we focus too much on the term of media, we might suffer the same fate as cybernetics in the 1970s when it more or less died, because the term ultimately comes from 19th century physics and the concept of the ether in radio, and the idea that you are sending something over the ether. This concept is still existing. Originally, medium means something in the middle, so it means something between a sender and a receiver, but what has happened is that the concept got greatly inflated. So, for example, we also speak of radio stations as media, or even we talk of radio receiving machines, a radio that we buy as a medium. So the term got gradually more expanded and doesn't really mean anymore what it originally meant. McLuhan even makes it more or less a synonym of all technology by even calling light bulbs and revolvers media, and calling them extension of man, which is, in my opinion, a generic definition of technology. Even if we talk about media in the more specific sense, which seems to be more closer to a common sense of information technology, I think it is problematic because, for example, computers are not just transmitters. So if we describe computers as media, I think we are missing a few aspects of them, because computers are processors. That means that within the limitations of formal programming, there can also be senders and receivers of information and processors of information. And if we talk, for example, of machines that sustain people in emergency rooms in hospitals, which are software programs, I don't think that the notion of the medium makes much sense there anymore. Then there's also the problem that the notion of the medium is very much linked to the idea of something that is material technology. But what is the case? Well, how to then analyze exactly those phenomena that I was showing here, those permutational poems, which do not physically rely on the material technology in most cases, but where the actual computation of the piece happens in one's mind. Or in the case of the code works of Mez and Jody, it is even imaginary programming language. It's not even proper algorithmic codes, but it's something that, a fantasy programming language that only through the human imagination becomes this hybrid of a program code and a normal standard English writing. I don't think that the notion of the medium can properly grasp that, and that it has been inflated and therefore needs to be criticized, because otherwise I think we're running in danger of, because nobody really knows what a medium is, we run the risk of having a field that always delivers a promise, like we will get our act together, we will at some point know more certainly or have more refined methodology, but failing to deliver that and using the term media more or less institutionally, that for example journalism studies reclaim media for themselves, then interdisciplinary humanities reclaim media for themselves, on the other hand, empirical media studies reclaim the media for itself. The same in art, video art, computer art, totally different phenomena. There is no art without a medium, so what is the meaning of that term at all? I think that needs to be criticized, and if one looks thoroughly at any phenomenon that is commonly associated to the term media or media art, then one quickly finds out that it's not really sufficient, and it's rather frustrating to deal with this term. This is what I'm trying to write in the last chapter, and I will end with that.
Just sit down maybe for a minute.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So the first task we have to continue with that award now is to find a new name. But as ever, I mean, academic insight and research never changed the real process of living language that has been since Kant and since Aristotle. Nobody ever managed it. Yeah. So we're gonna stick to the term, knowing that it has its problems.
And I must also say that my perspective has changed a little bit, because I completed this dissertation before I went to Rotterdam to become the director of a media design program. So here's the living contradiction. And let's say from a tactical or institutional perspective, I totally understand its value. Because if we wouldn't have a media program in an art school, it would just be summarized under art and design, and it would simply mean that students who are doing really great work with electronic technology wouldn't have a home, or maybe they would have a home, but they wouldn't have competent teachers who are specialized on that field. Yeah. So I see a pragmatic value in it. Yeah. Maybe one could find a different term on the. Ars Electronica, I think, is actually a very nice term.
Yeah,
don't use the term media, and I think it's a pretty clever name, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, but what you have been talking about now at the end is very much in line with what the strategy of our research work inside the institute is anyway, because I think that much of electronic art is very much limited in the awareness and in the recognition it gets, because it always put into this specific corner, which sometimes is even called a ghetto. And so we try to connect it to the other fields of knowledge production and aesthetic production. So we found that in even the critical sense, very much in line of what we want to do. So we almost end the end of time. We have already extended a little bit, but we stayed a little later, so we may have like the occasion for two or three questions from the public, if there are any. Okay. Over there. Somebody has a microphone here? Mm-hmm. And in the back. Yeah. Ah, yeah, okay.
Danke.
So we have three questions now, so that's it. Okay. Yeah, okay. So Karin, Wien might start, then you, and then you in the front. Yeah, okay. Sorry, now it's three only. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Okay. I found that absolutely fascinating and a very stimulating presentation. And just speaking for myself, I have a background in literature, linguistics, media studies. I could maybe talk for five minutes about programming, but I know very little about mathematics. Would I be able to follow your book? Is it written in a way that people without a background in programming and mathematics can understand it?
I hope so, yes. Yeah? Okay.
So you, maybe?
Yes. You mentioned a lot of things that you research, but what I'm missing a bit is an analysis and a conclusion. Let me emphasize on this. All these, for instance, setting up a machine, you set up a high-dimensional space, it's a search space, and you select things that are worthy or not worthy. It's searching in a search space, and not all the permutations are valid, usually.
Yeah.
And so there's, so it's 5% are valid or not. Now, all these people that you selected, they all have their own, say, domain. Is there something, did you analyze that, what they have in common? And things like beauty or rhythm or metrum or something like that.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about
it? Yes, I can talk about it. It's exactly the problem if I have to give this presentation in half an hour or 20 minutes. What I skipped, for example, is that if you look at the Skaliger poem, it actually has a hexameter. And that limits the amount of permutations that are valid if you still keep the meter. And that clearly, that's not just interesting from a formal standpoint, but it also is a very clear indication of where aesthetically and poetically this poem comes from. It is not so much interested in the actual computation, but it is interesting in the, it is focusing on the rhetorical copier, on the elegance of the rhyme and the elegance of the Latin language, which doesn't need article in order to designate different grammatical word classes. So it is about something like a flow, a poetic flow of the language, which then gets realized into a poem that can have different shapes. And then you can actually see how in the 17th century, a second form of that type of proteic verse was invented that no longer had a hexameter and that used alexandrines. With that device, it was possible to have an exact equation of the poetical and the mathematical permutation, because those poets, like Hausdorffer, like Kuhlmann, were actually interested in the computability. And that was what they, as Christian Kabbalists and Lullists, they were really interested in order, like the mainstream of Lullist encyclopedist science in the 17th century, to find something like a computational formula for the world. And make their poetry not only an allegoric description of it, but actually a physical incorporation of that. Yeah.
So maybe the last question we just can answer in one sentence.
I'm sorry, it's not a question. I feel like precising it, because probably confused by the interface that was going on its own and you're not familiar with it. You show a poem by the Jodis.
Yeah.
It's actually all C, but for one reason it's not C. There is just one detail that doesn't make it C, and it's the dollar in front of the soldiers.
Okay.